WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a great century for pop culture. It's the century in which rock and roll was born. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has chosen 10 recordings that he'd like to have with him if he were trapped on that proverbial desert island where so many critics seem to go. He chose 10 tracks that he thinks have proved to be very influential in the development of rock and roll. Let's start with a mix of the first five.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do.
I've been traveling over miles, even through the valleys too. I've been traveling in vain. I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter.
The way you're doing, done got wild. Oh, the way you're doing, if I keep loving you, my life will be ruined. I've done got here. I've been running around.
Time you dress so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you.
You started off with Chuck Berry's Maybelline. Why is that the starting point?
Well, that was Chuck Berry's first hit, and I think in a lot of ways it laid the groundwork for a lot of rock and roll for the next 50 years. Chuck Berry cut that in 1955, and you can hear that famous guitar riff in there that Chuck Berry, that you hear it in Keith Richards, you hear it just on through the history of rock and roll, that very fundamental rock and roll guitar riff. You know, Chuck Berry is somebody who was born in St. Louis in 1926. He started out, he was a beautician when he started out and playing blues in blues bands. And he kind of developed rock and roll almost single-handedly, almost in isolation. He was someone, when I look at the lyrics to Chuck Berry's songs, a song like Maybelline and other songs of his like Roll Over Beethoven and Too Much Monkey Business and School Days, he was one of the first black performers to recognize a teen subculture and a white teen subculture, and to talk to white teens in their terms. He kind of dropped the vocabulary of black blues men and tailored his lyrics in a lot of ways to the white audience that he wanted to cross over to.
And when did you first hear Chuck Berry? At what point were you in your music listening?
Well, when I was a little kid. I mean, my father was a big country music fan, and my mother was a rock and roll fan. And Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley were the two people that they could agree upon as being really good musicians. So I heard a lot of Chuck Berry in the house, and a lot of Elvis Presley were my first rock and roll records that I really heard.
Which leads us right to your second choice, Elvis Presley.
Yes, exactly. I chose Trying to Get to You. I just love this song. I think Trying to Get to You was released in 1956. It was part of the Mystery Train sessions that he did for Sun Records. It was his first kind of batch of those very primal songs that he cut. It was never released as a single, but I think it's a wonderful example of his vocal range. I mean, it starts off as a ballad, and yet it develops into this very bluesy. He ends up by the bridge. He's giving out with this bluesy growl. It just shows him at the peak of his power, and I think it's just a wonderful cut.
Next on the list is James Brown.
James Brown, yeah. This cut that we played was called Get It Together. It was cut in 1967, and to me it combines all the essential elements, first and foremost of which is an emphasis on rhythm over melody. I think this is James Brown's great contribution to rock and roll, is the idea that you can take a rhythm track and essentially make that the essential structure of a song. A lot of James Brown songs are just, his vocals are basically chants or exhortations, basically following the beat. And I think the vocal on this song is very bluesy, unlike a lot of his hit singles. It tells a real story. It talks about how to sustain a relationship. It has a kind of lyric to it that a lot of James Brown songs don't. So I thought it kind of encapsulated a lot of his strengths. About midway through the song, you wouldn't have heard this because it's too far deep into the song, but the song just explodes into this long instrumental section with trumpeter Maceo Parker taking a wonderful jazz solo in the middle of this funk cut. And to me, this is also a kind of bridge in the history that I'm presenting to you, in that Maceo Parker became part of George Clinton's band at a certain point in the late 70s and 80s and became part of the Parliament Funkadelic aggregation. And certainly, I just think that, to me, Elvis Presley and James Brown are kind of the fundamentals of rock and roll in that sense.
Are there any places you think James Brown led to that you wouldn't have been able to predict when he started doing his thing?
Well, I think that hip-hop today, in the sense that so much hardcore rap is very much stripped-down music, and I think that that owes a lot to James Brown showing that rhythm can carry the song, that you don't necessarily need a melody, that you can essentially talk over a rhythm track, which very often is what James Brown did and which is obviously what a lot of rappers do.
And next on your list was Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. Highway 61 Revisited was the album. The song is Like a Rolling Stone from 1965. I was looking at this book, which I think is neglected, by Tim Riley, that was published a couple of years ago, called Hard Rain. And he says about the first words of the song Like a Rolling Stone, when Dylan says Once Upon a Time, he says that is the most sarcastic fairy tale entrance to kick off a prolonged insult, which I think does describe the song very well. This song, it clocked in ultimately at 6 minutes, 13 seconds. Dylan insisted that it be released as the single from the album, which was at the time unheard of, at the time when most singles were 3 minutes or less. The entire song is a kind of accident. Al Kooper came into the recording session. He just wandered in by accident and ended up providing the keyboards that became essentially the lead instrument of the song. And yet, it's a perfect piece of music for all of its sprawling length and all of its essential chanciness. It's a very angry song. It's a song basically about humiliating the person that Bob Dylan was addressing, all his bile and anger.
Which was something he liked to do on his records.
Yes, indeed. And it's something that you really didn't hear much. I mean, there's certainly a lot of anger in rock and roll. But I think that very rarely before Dylan did you have somebody directing a song very specifically at a specific person being vindictive in a very specific way. And to me, it points forward to a lot of the anger of punk rock. Certainly Dylan is the epitome of the singer-songwriter. He began as a folk singer, began by covering other people's songs. Nowadays says that's what a folk singer should do, is go back, and he's recorded albums of folk songs, not his own. But he stands as the ultimate singer-songwriter. After Dylan, it was almost impossible for someone with a guitar to walk into a record label and not have written his or her own material.
Well, next on your list is the Beatles, a band that, in everyone's estimation, really changed the course of pop music.
Yeah, the Beatles certainly changed everything about rock and roll. It was a they came along there after Elvis Presley. They were the great pop phenomenon, I think. I think when people first saw them here on the Ed Sullivan Show, they realized something completely new had happened in rock and roll. And that was the fact that these four kids got together and wrote, again, the factor of writing your own material was very different from Elvis Presley. The fact that you could write in an enormous range of styles. The song that I chose, She Said, She Said, I wanted to play a song that had a John Lennon vocal because I think he is indisputably the genius of the group, and I think that this is the best of his songs on their best album. When you listen to She Said, She Said, it's a song about confusion and frustration and a kind of hopeless nostalgia. He says, "She said, I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it's like to be sad, and she's making me feel like I've never been born." It's a very kind of spacey, almost stream of consciousness, kind of nattering kind of lyric, yet very artful in the context of the melody of the song. He says in the during the bridge, "When I was a boy, everything was right." You know, John Lennon actually had a very unhappy childhood, but that kind of dreaminess to the song, I think, is very effective. And there are guitar riffs that are played backwards. The Beatles were very innovative in terms of what they did with George Martin as producer, in terms of their production techniques. At the time, this struck us as very psychedelic to hear these kind of guitar riffs played backwards and used as melody lines. And there are constant shifts in this song in time and meter that you just hadn't heard before. I think it's a very striking song for that reason.
Yeah, and the Beatles also had this kind of connection to songwriting, to music hall, or to a Tin Pan Alley kind of sound that I think served them really well.
Yeah, it wasn't as if they were rebelling against that. They listened to the songs that their parents played and used it when they thought they could use it in novel ways in their songs. Again, it wasn't about a kind of anger or rebellion a lot of times. I think that's the biggest lie as I look back over the history of rock and roll, that rock and roll is the voice of youth and rebellion. I mean, you know, Chuck Berry was a grown man when he made Maybelline. You know, Elvis Presley always looked back to older role models, to Bing Crosby, to Dean Martin for his vocal style. This is not essentially a music of revolt.
My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Well, on this eve of the new millennium, Ken Tucker is with us, Fresh Air's pop critic, and we've asked him to choose what he considers to be 10 of the most significant records in the history of rock and roll. Next, we have two singer-songwriters, and why don't we hear them first and then talk about why you've chosen them. Should we introduce them or just let them play?
I think we should probably introduce them. Randy Newman, it's from his 1970 album 12 Songs, and the song is called Suzanne. And Joni Mitchell from her 1971 album, Blue, and the song is called River.
I saw your name, baby, in a telephone book. Told all about your mom. Boy, I hope it was the truth. Could skate away on. It's
Joni Mitchell and Randy Newman, two of the top 10 recordings that our rock critic Ken Tucker has chosen, top from the history of rock and roll. Well, let's go back to Randy Newman. We are really in the singer-songwriter era. Where do you see Randy Newman as fitting into that?
Well, I'm letting poor old misanthropic Randy Newman carry the weight of all singer-songwriterdom, because I think he can carry that weight. You know, in his music, he's written some beautiful, beautiful songs over the past quarter century. You know, he can write everything from the Toy Story soundtracks these days to, you know, this kind of song that we just heard, Suzanne. That specific song, Suzanne, is an interesting one because it's part of the idea that at the time, singer-songwriters were supposedly writing always about themselves. It was always first person. Anything you heard was supposedly an expression of the songwriter's inner feelings and thoughts and beliefs. Randy Newman, he fought against that almost instinctively. The narrator in this song is a stalker. Is a guy who's following Suzanne, who follows her into a movie theater and says, you know, I'll be sitting right behind you, very menacingly. At the same time, he's kind of pathetic. He's interested in presenting people who don't normally make it into rock and roll songs. Rock and roll songs tend to either be about, you know, winners or macho guys. Randy Newman reacts against that kind of stuff.
Well, let's go to Joni Mitchell, who's probably the mother of singer-songwriters in a lot of ways. I mean, Carole King, too, but Joni Mitchell is, I think, more directly connected probably to the type of singer-songwriter we're hearing now.
Yeah, I mean, now, you know, Jewel, Annie DeFranco, Lucinda Williams even, are unthinkable without the example of Joni Mitchell. I chose River partly because my little holiday salute is the the Jingle Bells piano riff so soon after Christmas that begins this song. But, you know, this album is the enduring emblem to me of a woman making popular music on her own terms. She produced the album herself. A lot of the songs don't follow conventional verse, chorus, verse structures. She says things in the song like, she has a line, I'm selfish and I'm sad. And she says that without a trace of shame or self-consciousness. And, you know, the fact that pretty soon after the release of this album, she completely repudiated all of its innovations to make much more jazzy, more pretentious music, to me doesn't lessen its greatness. It just enhances it, I think.
Ken Tucker is with us, Fresh Air's rock critic, and as we prepare for the new millennium, we've asked him to choose what he considers to be 10 of the most significant rock and roll tracks in the history of rock and roll. And why don't you introduce the next track for us?
Yeah, the next selection is the title song from Al Green's 1973 album. It's called Call Me.
What a beautiful time we had together. It's getting late and we must leave each other.
Ken, why did you choose this as one of the 10 most significant tracks?
Well, in a sense, you know, given only 10 tracks to play with you, I guess this might or should have been a Motown act. But to me, Al Green, his early hits subsume Motown soul music and extend it, I think. To me, no male soul singer, with the possible exceptions of Sam Cooke and Stevie Wonder, have ever sounded so much in love with women. I remember one show that I saw in New York City. It was at a time when he used to regularly climax every show by coming out and throwing roses into the audience, to women in the audience. And these women had rushed the stage, and he had emptied his arms of the roses he had, and he was still singing, and he was looking down at these two women who were just kind of looking with their hands up, and he took off his shoes, and he gave one to each of them. It was like he would do anything for a woman to please her. I just think he's just a remarkable guy. And to me, he influenced everybody from Teddy Pendergrass to contemporary singer and producer Kenneth Babyface Edmonds. I think only Marvin Gaye is arguably his peer in terms of the kind of range that Al Green could do. I think if I had another spot on this list, I'd probably play Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. But Al Green also, soon after this, about 3 years after this, abandoned secular music and became essentially a preacher and gospel singer. He's, in fact, now the pastor in Memphis at the Full Gospel Tabernacle. And has launched a kind of second career as a gospel singer.
He's given his shoes to God now.
Exactly. That's real tithing.
We're with Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. We'll get back to his list of 10 favorite recordings from the history of rock and roll after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. He's brought 10 of his favorite recordings from the history of rock and roll, recordings that have been influential in the music's development. When we left off, we were talking about soul and gospel singer Al Green. Well, your next choice heads in a completely different direction, and that's Elvis Costello.
Yes. This is from his 1980 album called, as always with Elvis Costello, Irony. It's called Get Happy, and the track is High Fidelity.
Elvis Costello, one of the tracks our rock critic Ken Tucker has chosen as among 10 of the most significant tracks in the history of rock and roll. Why'd you choose this one?
Sheer cussedness and perversity. I think even Elvis Costello fans don't think Get Happy is his best album. I insist that it is. 20 songs, only one of them over 3 minutes. To me, this is the epitome of punk attitude throughout this album. It shows his growth as, I mean, Costello started out in the late 70s in the wake of punk rock. He was reacting to and influenced by groups like the Sex Pistols and the Clash. He felt that kind of rage. He felt that kind of sense of do it yourself. You didn't have to be a great musician to pick up a guitar, go into a studio, and cut your music. He essentially started his own label to get his music distributed. He worked with Nick Lowe, was his producer. And he was lumped in initially as a punk, but very quickly showed much more ambition and range and interest in melody than the punks did.
Well, Ken, the tension is building. What will your final selection be as among the 10 most significant tracks?
It will be by George Clinton, and the song is called Atomic Dog.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs.
Well, Ken, I'm not surprised that George Clinton made it onto your 10 best in the history of rock. Tell us why.
Well, I wrote a piece for the Village Voice in the late 80s in which I called George Clinton the great pop brain of our era. And I said this because of his limitations. He doesn't have a great voice. You'd never see him play an instrument on stage. Yet he's managed to head up two of rock and roll's most important bands, Parliament and Funkadelic. He's turned out so many memorable musical riffs, refrains, verbal catchphrases, more than any contemporary musician.
Including?
You know, including every hip-hop act, basically. You know, his music has been sampled. I mean, he's Grateful Dead-like in his generosity. He encourages his music to be sampled. He was very foresighted in recognizing that his career would be only furthered by allowing young rappers to take riffs of his songs and stick them in the middle of theirs and use them as hooks. I also like the way he kind of cuts to the chase. I love his vulgarity. I love his openness in talking about sex and the relationship between men and women. I think Atomic Dog, the refrain is, why must I feel like that? Why must I chase the cat? Everything comes down to men and women, fundamental relationships. I just think he's at once a very brainy yet very from the gut instinctive musician.
The end of the year wouldn't be complete unless we heard your picks for the best records of the year. So those of us who are enjoying lists or have another one to enjoy.
My top 10 is at number 1, The Magnetic Field, 69 Love Songs, Randy Newman, Bad Love, Beck's Midnight Vultures, Fiona Apple's When the Pawn, TLC's album Fan Mail, Steve Earle's The Mountain, Teddy Morgan and the Pistols' Lost Love and Highways, a really good debut album. Kelly Willis's What I Deserve. Ron Sexsmith's Whereabouts. And Buddy Miller's Cruel Moon.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for being with us. And I want to wish you a really happy new year and a good new millennium.
Same to you.
And many more.
Thank you. And same to you very much indeed, Terry.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy new year, and we hope your computers and electricity continue to function when the clock strikes midnight.